Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from March 18th to March 24th. Hey, Anthony, want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So just a few call-outs this week. So we had Vitalik on the podcast. That was, you know, pretty cool on Into the Ether. We had been setting this up for quite a while. We didn't tell anyone about it We had it in the queue for a few weeks, and then finally had him on and released the episode. And I didn't get any sneak peeks of the episode myself. I listened to it at the same time as everyone else, and I really enjoyed it. We'd love to thank Vitalik if he's listening to the recap for coming on, because it was a great honor, obviously getting him on the podcast. And he loves all the stuff we're doing with ETHub as well, I think, which is really cool to see. If you haven't listened to the podcast yet, go give it a listen. We walk through basically ETH 1.x, ETH 2, kind of governance questions around Ethereum and all that sort of stuff, straight from the horse's mouth, basically. So yeah, it was a great listen, and go check it out. And also, we were on the Gitcoin live stream this week as well, a couple of days ago. So this is a live stream that Gitcoin put together with community members. So Eric and I went on and we discussed ETHub. We ran through basically what we're doing with ETHub and basically what we think of Ethereum's kind of monetary policy going forward. And then I walked through my blog post about why Ether is valuable, basically discussing the economics behind Ether itself, you know, what has caused the price to rise so much so far, and kind of things like that as well. We touched on economic abstraction as well, which is a really important topic. So I linked the recap to that live stream in the newsletter. So definitely go check that one out. So Eric, did you want to discuss a little bit about what you talked about in the live stream?
Yeah, so I guess first of all, thanks a lot to the Gitcoin team for inviting us on. It was pretty cool. And like you mentioned, you can go back and watch it. I think the whole thing ended up like an hour and 30 minutes. There was someone from POA Network that kind of took the final half and we were the first half. But we just kind of walked through ETHub and kind of why I got started and where we're headed in the next couple of months, or at least what we see and vision for the site. And then we talked about the monetary policy, which is kind of, we had walked through what our top requested pages are, so kind of like our top eight hits, and our top few pages are always around either ETH 2.0 economics or the monetary policy, things like that. So we walked through the monetary policy, kind of the history of it, what it was originally envisioned as, what it is now, transitioned in that into what you talked about, you know, why Ether is valuable, and then is Ether money and all that stuff. So we just kind of, first of all, most importantly, I guess, gave a recap on ETHub and where we're headed. But, you know, it's very important to both of us that, and to the entire network, that Ether has value and we have strong economics and monetary policy behind it. So anybody kind of interested in those topics, definitely go check it out.
Yeah, and just speaking of recaps as well, last week, our weekly recap, we noticed a pretty deep drop-off in listeners. I think it was because we released it on the same day as the Vitalik podcast, so people may have missed it. So if you're interested in listening to that last week's recap, so for the week prior's news newsletter, you can definitely go check that out. You'll have two to listen to, obviously this one and last week's one, so bonus. So I'll move on to the news. This week, there was just one kind of, highlight in the news, and that was that Square, the payments company that Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, it's his company, they basically announced that they're hiring crypto engineers. So this was really interesting because Jack's been a pretty big Bitcoin bull for a while. He hasn't really done much in the wider crypto ecosystem. It's always been about Bitcoin, especially Lightning Network. Obviously, he was, if you've been on Twitter, you would have seen that he was a part of what was called the Lightning Torch. But he didn't call the new Twitter account associated with this Square Bitcoin. He called it Square Crypto. So it's kind of, shows me that he's branching out from his Bitcoin kind of bullishness or just being in the Bitcoin ecosystem and coming into, the wider crypto ecosystem. I'd really like to see him get involved more with Ethereum and check out, what Ethereum enables and things like that. I think that he's in a kind of a Bitcoin bubble because he's involved with Lightning Labs, which is building the Lightning Network, or one of the teams building the Lightning Network. He's an investor in Lightning Labs. But it's good to see it, that, you know, it's called Square Crypto. They're currently hiring 4 full-time people to work, including one designer as well, to work on, you know, both Bitcoin Core, even like at the protocol level, and also other, you know, crypto projects. He didn't mention anything in particular, but I'm assuming, you know, Ethereum would be definitely up on the list there of people that he'd want to fund to build stuff like that. So yeah, it was really cool to see just this branch out. Of course, you know, a few of the Bitcoiners got upset that it wasn't Square Bitcoin and then Square Crypto and all this stuff, but it's just noise at the end of the day. I think it's good that, you know, you can start off as like maybe a Bitcoin person, and kind of Bitcoin's that entry for people because it's a lot easier to understand. It's just, I mean, the narrative is that it's digital gold and then it's kind of money. Whereas Ethereum, it can be more complex to understand, even though that, you know, we think Ethereum is money and is a store of value and all that good stuff as well. Ethereum can do a lot more. So just by that nature, it does lend itself to being more complex and taking a bit longer for people to learn what it is. So yeah, what did you think of this one, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I guess everyone, I guess at this point knows, like you mentioned, Jack is invested in Lightning Labs and definitely has not been shy of kind of pushing Bitcoin and Lightning Network on Twitter before. I guess I won't dive fully into my thoughts there. If people have listened to recaps in the past, they kind of know them. But yeah, it makes sense that they would hire more general crypto engineers. I mean, the whole, I've said it before, in my opinion, I think Bitcoin at this point should almost just settle into the digital gold narrative. I, you know, most people I see online think of it as that, and I don't really see it as a payment solution in the near term or long term future. I think things like DAI payment solutions, like we've seen with the Burner Wallet, Connex Network, CryptoStall, the ones that we've talked about in the past. I mean, I think if we're talking like mainstream adoption of crypto in the next 5 to 10 years, people are going to want something like DAI, right? Where people aren't going to want to pay for things, especially on social networks, or you know, if you think of like something like an Apple Pay or Venmo, stuff like that, people aren't going to want to pay with crypto. It's just too volatile. So maybe they're exploring other options like that and kind of venturing into stable coins as well. Who knows? But at the end of the day, it seems like Jack's a pretty hardcore Bitcoin bull. I think when he was kind of passing around that Bitcoin torch that you were talking about, someone had asked him like, do you buy Ether or something like that? And he was like, no. So who knows? I mean, he seems pretty heavily invested in Bitcoin, but at the same time, he's got to make the right move for his company and his shareholders and stakeholders in Square. And if we're being honest, that probably means he needs to look into other solutions as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see something like DAI be integrated on Square. That would be kind of a resounding stamp of approval. Something like DAI, Bitcoin's already on there. I'm pretty sure you can buy Bitcoin through the Square app, kind of things like that. I'm assuming that Jack's definitely, you know, keeping an eye on integrating Lightning Network into the Square kind of cash app, as it's called. Lightning Network is nowhere near ready for that. And to be fair, neither is Ethereum. If, you know, millions of people were trying to use DAI for everyday purchases, it would clog the entire network. So we're definitely still in the early days. It's not ready for that. So I'm hoping that over the next few years, if Jack still wants to be involved with Bitcoin and crypto, he kind of sees the value behind Ethereum as well. And, you know, we do some more evangelizing there. I did remember reading the comment about him saying no to Ethereum when someone said, you know, you want to buy ETH. I honestly think he just doesn't, or hasn't looked into ETH. Not that he doesn't understand it, maybe he just hasn't looked into ETH and Ethereum and all the good stuff happening on it. Because I think that's what happens with a lot of people who start off as Bitcoiners. They get trapped in this kind of echo chamber because a lot of the, I guess, main Bitcoin channels are quite weird. So like our Bitcoin, like the subreddit for Bitcoin is heavily censored. You can't actually talk about anything else on there except Bitcoin. Like nothing else can get through even. It's not even upvote or downvote. It's literally removed from the subreddit. You know, and then on Twitter, when you join, you're always kind of the suggested followers are always Bitcoiners because they have the most followers. It's all that sort of stuff, right? And then people tend to get stuck in this echo chamber. But then I see when people discover kind of what's happening on Ethereum, they look at it, they discover it, they play around with it. And it's just really cool to see these people discover apps like Maker, you know, Compound, you know, DAI in general, and using DAI for purchases and things like that, and even crypto games, all this sort of stuff. They discover it, they play around with it, and like, oh, this Ethereum thing's actually quite cool. That's what needs to happen. And I think that's what's going to happen with Jack eventually as well. He's a very busy man. Obviously, he runs two companies, two successful companies, you know, and Twitter being as big as it is, he's got a lot more to worry about than I think crypto at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, as far as, you know, we talked a few weeks ago, mainstream adoption so far, you kind of have Samsung and Opera, and both of those have been Ethereum wallets. So it'll be interesting to see as more kind of companies come on. I mean, if you're adopting Bitcoin into your solution, it's more just kind of like buy and send, which I guess you can do on Square now. But as far as like actually interacting and kind of maybe pushing the envelope a little further, like at this point, it's kind of Ethereum's the only option. It's not to say, I guess, that it's going to be the only option into the near future. I mean, a lot of people think Lightning Network can get there, but you know, as far as like interacting with the blockchain at this point, it's kind of just Ethereum. So it'll be interesting. Like, Samsung and Opera aren't going to be the only ones that kind of push into the blockchain space in 2019 by any means.
Yeah, it'll just kind of be like a snowball effect where all these companies start releasing different wallets and things for different networks. We're going to see lots of these things pop up, and whatever's best will win at the end of the day. You know, that's how it always goes. So that's it for the news this week. There's a few project updates I want to get through. So the first one, it's a sad kind of one, is that Mist, the original kind of interface Web3 client for the Ethereum ecosystem. You know, it's been around since, I think, you know, basically the birth of Ethereum. That was announced by the founder, Alex, this week, that it's being discontinued. This was for two main reasons, security and ecosystem. So security, the kind of technology that they were building Mist on, Electron, is not secure. It's not secure enough. It doesn't let them do a lot of things they wanted to do for Mist on it, using it. So they would have to migrate it to an entirely different platform if they wanted to do it, all these different things. And then secondly, ecosystem. There are a lot more options now. There are a lot more options for interfacing with Web3, with the Ethereum network, with, you know, having wallets and things like that. Like, I was looking through the app store the other day, and there are like literally, I think, 50 plus different Ethereum wallets on there. A lot of them reputable as well. Like, of course, there are some, you know, maybe dodgy ones on there and things like that. But we're definitely not in 2015, 2016 anymore. We've seen an explosion of these sorts of things. But I'll let you kind of talk to Mist a bit, Eric, because this is before my time in Ethereum. I never actually used Mist. My first wallet was my Ether wallet. So yeah, take it away.
Yeah, I guess this is a bittersweet. Like, on one end, it's kind of like the first kind of aha moment of what you could do with Ether, at least kind of on the wallet and Web3 side. But then at the same time, it kind of just means that the ecosystem and development's progressing so much and so fast that, you know, some people just can't keep up with that development. I don't think Mist had put out an update in like a year, and even that might have been a security update. So it's been a year to 2 years since any real features. I mean, yeah, it was kind of like you said. I mean, it was the first wallet. I remember for a while it was like you would download the Ethereum wallet, which was like Mist, but just the wallet side. And then Mist was literally like a Web3 browser. It was like a full featured browser that hooked into your wallet. So kind of think MetaMask, but it actually was your browser as well. So obviously now if you're browsing to websites in like Chrome or Brave or whatever, like your browser takes care of the browsing, and then Mist just hooks into the Web3 side. Or I'm sorry, and your browser just hooks into the Web3 side. Mist was trying to do it all. So I mean, very ambitious project, but you know, it kind of got everything kickstarted. Alex, I guess, just, or the team just hasn't been able to keep up with it. So like I said, I mean, that's on the good side. That means that there's a lot of good competitors out there, and MetaMask and MyEther wallet and just all the mobile wallets that are coming out. And you know, I don't know if anybody had been using it for like the last year, although I'm pretty sure if you go to ethereum.org, it still redirects you to download Mist. So I think Alex is one of the gatekeepers on the GitHub for the ethereum.org website. So hopefully, if he hasn't already, he takes down links to Mist, because if they're discontinuing it, I mean, we all know ethereum.org has problems. It hasn't been updated in 2 years, but hopefully we're not still linking to defunct software.
Just redirect ethereum.org to ETHub. Everyone wants it. Yeah, the entire community is behind this. Yeah.
Let's just get it done.
Yeah. But yeah, no. Yeah, so bittersweet, of course, that this being discontinued. But I'm actually interested to see what Alex van der Sand is his full name, what he kind of works on next. I think he's still part of the Ethereum Foundation. So yeah, we'll see what he, you know, works on from here.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website right now, by the way, and it's definitely still up there. So I might submit a pull request to just delete this entire. Actually, this is going way off topic, but it literally, like, the ethereum.org/crowdsale basically tells you how to get in trouble with the SEC. It's like, oh, you could create tokens and sell them and mist. Like, it's amazing how outdated it is.
Yeah. Just sneak in a little, redirect to ETHUB while you put in a pull request to remove mist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Cool. So the next thing that was released this week was Counterfactual. Now, Counterfactual are building generalized state channels. And this week they released their playground on the alpha version of their playground on the, I think it's on Rigby testnet. So basically this lets people test and experiment with generalized state channels. There's a few demo kind of apps on there and things like that. We've covered state channels in our intro to Ethereum scaling. We also had, we've also talked about this in the past as well. State channels is a layer 2 scaling solution for Ethereum. And this was kind of long awaited, this playground, because it lets anyone experiment and build things. It's still very early, of course, but it's good to see that these playgrounds kind of out there and people are able to build on it, basically.
Yeah, we had Liam on the podcast, one of our original guests, actually, and they were talking about it then. I think then it was like, oh, a couple of weeks away, and I've kind of been poking at them a little bit on Twitter, like, hey, when's this coming? So I was super excited to see it. I signed up, super slick. You can go on. There's a couple game demos on there, but it's all done in state channels, and like what they're doing, of course, is their generalized state channel. So they're very easy, kind of like plug and play, like kind of anybody would be able to use this. Whereas say like a Raiden is a little bit more specialized, but you can go on, you can play like checkers and all that moves happen in a state channel. So you kind of open it up and then when the game's over, you close it out. I mean, to me, this is one of the most all-star teams, in my opinion, that's out there. I think they're doing a lot of good work, like just the playground, which, and it's only their alpha, super smooth. Like I really like what I'm seeing here. So I'm personally very bullish on generalized state channels by Counterfactual. So hopefully the team keeps up the good work.
Yeah, and it really just shows like kind of the magic of these scaling solutions. We've had Plasma for a little while now. I think we had Loom working on some Plasma stuff, and then there's other things like Plasma Bears, a couple of Plasma games. There was another one, I can't remember what it was now, but basically, we're seeing the early signs of these technologies, spring to life in a kind of not production ready, obviously, but kind of way for end users to play around with it and to see what's possible using these technologies. Because obviously, one of the biggest thing around Ethereum has been that it, lacks scale, which of course is true. And we've got ETH 2.0 coming for that with sharding, but we've also got layer 2 technology coming before that, because we know that we won't have full sharding until phase 2 of ETH 2.0, and there's still a lot of other kind of things that need to be worked on to make it kind of work the same way as ETH 1. And this is another reason why I speak on Twitter as well a lot about how Ethereum 1.0 and ETH 1.x is going to be around for quite a while, and it's quite bullish in general. Like, we don't have to wait for ETH 2.0. We're going to have these layer 2 scaling solutions before ETH 2.0. We're going to have all the networks of ETH 1 still there, all the network effects. It's going to take maybe 2 or 3 years before, people start kind of migrating en masse to ETH 2.0, especially because we need phase 2 rolled out. So while that's happening, we're still going to be able to do a lot of stuff on ETH 1, and then eventually everyone will just migrate across. And, sharding doesn't fix all scaling, basically. It'll give us a lot of scaling, obviously. Tens of thousands of transactions, I think, last time I kind of checked. But it's not, that can still become kind of clogged depending on how big Ethereum gets. Like, if Ethereum becomes kind of the backbone of the world's financial system, that's definitely not enough transactions. And you also have to pay gas for every transaction on mainnet, so we definitely still need these layer 2 solutions to offer kind of either free or really, really, really cheap transactions with while being secured by the Ethereum main chain. In addition to Plasma and state channels, we also have zero knowledge proofs, which is really cool. Vitalik did a presentation a few days ago about how this new kind of zero knowledge rollups can be used. This is like dark magic to me, but can be used to scale to hundreds of thousands of transactions a second in phase 1 of ETH 2.0. So we have all this awesome kind of tech building on Ethereum that's just, it's just we're finally seeing it come to life after waiting for so long, because it's still, you know, obviously a lot of this stuff has to go through research and development. They're literally inventing new things here and playing around with them. So yeah, very excited to see the playground. I definitely suggest go checking it out. And I think while you're playing these games, it's very prudent to realize that this is running inside this kind of brand new tech state channels on an Ethereum network. It's obviously it's on the testnet, but it's still on an Ethereum network. Because maybe some of you have played around with other networks that claim a lot more scale, because they've kind of, you know, EOS, for example, only has 21 block producers, but they're only kind of, I guess, speedy with their games because they're basically like playing a kind of game on a centralized server or something like that. It's very similar. Whereas with Ethereum, these are being played on the completely decentralized Ethereum main chain. So it's very, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. You just said a lot of good stuff. And first, I totally agree with you. I mean, Ethereum 2.0, I'm confident it will happen, but at the end of the day, it's kind of a nice to have. Like, I think Ethereum can be successful with just ETH 1.0, eventually 1.x, because we need to get some kind of state control and state rent in there, I think, someday. But combined with these layer two solutions, it could go a very long way, at least get us, you know, for years and years to go. And again, I'm fully confident in 2.0, and I think it's vital what those teams are building out, but we can go super far with just 1.0 and layer two solutions. And then, like you said, I mean, where these layer two solutions are going to really take off is kind of what Counterfactual is doing with this playground. Like, you're when you go in there, the webpage is a state channel wallet. So they're running a hub. You all of a sudden have a wallet inside this hub. So everything you're doing in here is secured by the main base layer, like you were saying. And then your interactions inside the playground are zero fees and zero block confirmation times because your wallet's inside of this hub that they're running. So, I mean, the technology's there and people are starting to put a really good user experience around it. And it's definitely getting exciting.
Yeah, I went off on a bit of a tangent there, but I got pretty excited because we've obviously been waiting for this stuff for quite a while. This has been talked about for a long time. So it's just great to see them, you know, it being fleshed out and actually being able to play with it. Speaking of scalability, next thing I wanted to talk about was the Starkware DEX. So Starkware, also building, you know, scaling technology using zero knowledge proofs and that kind of dark magic that I was discussing just before. They put out an update on Twitter this week that their Stark DEX can now settle over 500 trades per second, costing less than 1,000 gas per trade, which is 200 times more trades than Ethereum can currently settle. So this is settling on the main Ethereum network. So it's not just kind of trades happening in the background on a kind of, you know, centralized order book or an off-chain order book. It's actually happening all on-chain on Ethereum 1.0 today. So this is just insane. This kind of stuff is so cool. And it's just, this team is one of the darlings of crypto as well. Like you mentioned, Counterfactual is one of the superstar teams. I think Starkware is as well. Vitalik's spoken a lot about zero knowledge proofs and he's quite bullish on what they can do for Ethereum. And Starkware, I think he's either an advisor to Starkware or heavily involved with the project and helping them with different things. But we did have them on the podcast as well, Eric. You interviewed them. How was that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite episodes. And well, so Vitalik's kind of run away with the popularity of episodes now. But until Vitalik came on, Starkware was our, I believe, still our number one episode. So definitely, if you haven't listened to that, go listen. And they definitely teased this at the time. So they're working with 0x is the partner at the time. They didn't announce that, but it's come out since then. I'm super bullish on this. I mean, we talk a lot, like liquidity is essential for decentralized exchanges, and you're not going to get liquidity until we can have some speed of trades. So yeah, they're claiming 500 trades a second. What's really cool is, I guess they're saying that the cost per trade is less than 1,000 gas, which is very interesting because the transfer just Ether to Ether, which is kind of the cheapest on-chain transaction you can do, is 21,000 gas, I believe. So I know they're doing some, like you said, voodoo black magic with their technology here. So I think I'm pretty sure they batched the trade, so that's why it's like less than, you know, just a typical ETH transfer would be. But yeah, they were saying 200 times more trades than Ethereum can currently settle. So I mean, this is great steps, and like this is live. It's not actually out for others to try quite yet. But I think it's going to be an alpha state for people to try very soon. So I mean, if we can start solving, like we talk a lot, people want to have custody of their funds, but you can't have too big of a trade-off on the other side. So you don't want to give up liquidity. You don't want to give up speed and other features that you can get on, say, like a Coinbase or whatever it might be. But if you start to like close that gap where all of a sudden trade speed's about the same, fees are less, like the user experience is about the same, then all of a sudden you kind of have like a tidal wave of people coming over because you can have custody of your funds and you don't have to give up a big amount of features as far as speed and fees and stuff like that goes. So I think this is going to be like one of those catalysts that really pushes decentralized exchanges finally. And I've been, of course, obsessed and kind of involved with decentralized exchanges for years now. This is kind of what we need to push them to the next level.
Yeah. And I think I do want to mention one thing. There is or are other decentralized exchanges claiming to have this much scalability, on other networks. So for example, Binance obviously has their decentralized exchange coming out quite soon and it's quite performant. This is because they're running Cosmos's kind of Tendermint consensus mechanism, which basically means they have like a, you know, I think they're going to have like less than 10 validators or something like that, or block producers or whatever you want to call them, all controlled by Binance or whatever. And then they say they'll decentralize further on later. So basically what they've built is not actually a decentralized exchange. It's the same thing. It's kind of a centralized exchange where you still maintain your assets as well as in control of your assets as well, but it's not the same thing. What Starkware is doing is using the current Ethereum network as it is with the thousands of nodes and thousands of miners to do these kind of DEX, completely non-custodial DEX in a scalable way. So I think it's good to make that distinction there as well, because some people might be a bit confused as to why these other networks can scale a lot more than Ethereum. Under the hood, in the kind of the tech back end of a lot of these things, there's a lot more at play. There was an interesting blog post. I can't remember what it was called, and I shouldn't mention it because you guys probably won't be able to find it because it's not linked in the newsletter. But it basically goes through going through Ethereum and taking out each kind of part of the tech stack to make it more performant, and you basically just re-centralize it. So it's that kind of whole thing of the maximally decentralized network is, needs to look into other areas of how to, you know, scale, how to do different things, especially in the kind of, layer one, layer two space as well. So obviously not everything can be done on layer one, as I just spoke about before. So yeah, definitely cool to see Starkware doing this stuff with their DEX.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're learning over the years, right, that heavy kind of contracts, transactions will need to happen on layer two, right? So things like DEXs, like obviously back in the day we tried with EtherDelta and stuff, all this stuff happened on chain, right? I think over 5 years now, or four, however long the Ethereum main chain's been out, it feels like 30 at this point. But I think we're learning that like a lot of these heavier transactions need to be off chain. Like I see a lot of the developers kind of tout on chain minimalism. Like it should just be very essential kind of just value transfers and settlement that happens on the main chain. So I think that's the vision, right? Like, yes, we're going to get sharding, which is going to multiply our transactions per second by like 1024. But eventually someday, hopefully the network's like used enough where that really is just value transfer and settlement. And then kind of all the heavier stuff happens on layer two solutions like this.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was like kind of the original Bitcoin vision as well, where the, you know, layer one would be that settlement kind of layer and, you know, everything else would be done at layer two. But as we know, Bitcoin is quite limited in that regard. It doesn't have a smart contracting language, very limited scripting language where you can't really do much. I think multisig is the most complicated thing you can do on Bitcoin. So yeah, Ethereum kind of has similar goals, but obviously has a Turing complete scripting language that you can do basically anything with. And that's why we see a lot of these things proliferate on Ethereum. Which is really cool to see. So last thing I wanted to talk about was Compound version 2 was announced. So Compound is a DeFi project that we're obviously quite bullish on. It's a money market protocol, basically lets you put assets into a pool, borrow assets out of the pool, earn interest, whether you're lending or borrowing, pay interest if you're borrowing, earn it if you're lending. So they announced version 2 of what they're aiming to do in version 2. They've got, I think it was like three core things that they're trying to do. So in version 2, it's a very similar system to what Multicollateral DAI will be for MakerDAO. So basically each asset in Compound V2 will have its own collateral factor. So this basically allows support for any asset. So you can imagine ETH having a lower collateralization ratio because it's more liquid. It's not as, you know, volatile as some of the other kind of tokens out there, whereas a smaller ERC20 token might have a lot higher collateralization ratio because it is less liquid. It's more it's obviously subject to wilder price swings and those sorts of things. So that's one major thing. The next one was they're supporting unwrapped Ether. So for those who've used DeFi apps, you know that you have to wrap your Ether into what's called wrapped Ether or WETH to use a lot of these things. So they're going to be supporting unwrapped Ether in version 2. They're also going to be supporting token pools and any other kind of standards that come out from this. So NFTs and things like that, I think, are included in that. And the last thing that we're going to do was improving the governance of each asset. So for example, the 0x gateway for Compound can be upgraded to allow 0x token holders to govern 0x's interest rate model, borrowing parameters, or the price feed. Now, that's really interesting. We've talked about kind of the on-chain governance mechanisms of these things before. I feel like Compound needs to really think about how they do this, because this basically opens them up to the will of each network's governance. So obviously the major networks on the DeFi side are 0x and Maker, where kind of governance leads to on-chain upgrades and things like that for different things. Like Maker, it's the stability fee. It's historically been the stability fee. And with 0x, it was basically just an upgrade to allow the trading of arbitrary bundles of tokens. So it'd be interesting to see how Compound handles the governance depending on what token it is and depending on like how much people show up to govern these different things, because I think it can get out of hand quite quickly.
Yeah, so I mean, we had Robert on the podcast a few weeks back. He hinted a little bit at version 2, but didn't go into the details, so I guess we have it now. I mean, yeah, I mean, on-chain governance, right? We talk about this a lot. I think most of the votes happening, like Maker, 0x, I think the most is like 0.5% voter turnout, which is just so pathetic. And like, no one's even thinking about voting. Like the leaders of the platforms are signaling and then everyone's just following, right? I just I don't know. Like, I definitely worry about, I guess I'll tease. So tomorrow we're going to have an episode with Rune, the founder and CEO of Maker. And we talk a lot about multi-collateral DAI, and I ask him a lot of questions around like, what do you think about the risk management of this? Do you think that the governance is actually going to be able to like find the right factors and the collateral ratios and the stability fees for all these different assets? Like, how do you manage that? I'm not convinced yet, to be honest, that this is going to be a good thing. And it seems like Compound's kind of going down the same road here. I mean, I'm all for experimentation and kind of seeing. I just feel like we're going to have some kind of cascade liquidation event at some point on these protocols that a lot of people are going to get burned. So, I mean, personally, I'm just going to stick to the most liquid if I use these, and that's on the Ether side. But hey, you know, we're trying things out here. How else are you going to figure out how to do this without having some kind of decentralized governance, I suppose? And you don't want just kind of one person having all these levers to play with. So, but in saying that, I do think we're going to see people get burned on these less liquid assets. So I personally am going to be staying away from that.
Yeah, governance is obviously this never-ending discussion. I was going to put a tweet out the other day and I decided not to because I was probably going to get flamed for it. But I basically just wanted to ask if anyone can tell me what mechanisms or kind of any projects that have solved the on-chain governance problem of where it just turns into a plutocracy, where because one coin equals one vote, obviously the largest coin holders have the most influence. So how does it not just devolve into a plutocracy? And I don't think anyone could actually answer that. I know there are other chains such as Decred that have functional on-chain governance systems, but I think a lot of these things function well, I guess you could say, until they don't. So, you know, you could imagine something like, obviously, I'm just going to bring up like the most contentious thing on Ethereum at the moment is the fund recovery, EIP 999, the frozen parity multisig funds. Now, you could imagine that there was an on-chain governance system on Ethereum and you could vote with your tokens. So what, Parity still has access to, well, Web3 Foundation still has the private keys to access their frozen funds. So that they could actually vote with those frozen funds as part of the on-chain governance system to unlock their frozen funds. And because they have a lot there, and because we've seen a lot of voter apathy from basically most people in the ecosystem, maybe that vote would go through. So, I mean, it depends, because when you're governing something, like we spoke about, you've got to make something worth governing. The Ethereum network, if it had on-chain governance, would probably have a much higher voter turnout than, you know, something like 0x or even Maker, because it's the network itself, right? There's a lot more people involved. There's a lot more, you know, there's exchanges involved. There's things like that. But it kind of goes back to my point of there are still big holders in the Ethereum ecosystem as well. So, you know, I feel like if it was up to on-chain voting, something like the fund recovery would go through, even though basically all the ecosystem, all the community members oppose it. Maybe those community members don't have large ETH holdings. They can't actually outvote the other people as well. So I'm curious. I mean, if people listen to this podcast, DM me, you know, try and change my mind, and even Eric as well, because we're both on the same page here. How do these systems not devolve into kind of plutocracies where the wealthy just control everything, basically?
Yeah, slide into our DMs. I tweeted out, I think, a couple of days ago, and I said on-chain governance is a marketing gimmick, and I firmly believe that. And Vitalik and I talked a little bit about it, and I mean, we didn't go that far to say that, but I mean, it is kind of sold as a feature of these networks, and I kind of think, you know, we don't have a name for Ethereum's governance, but it's worked fine so far. Yes, we have a lot of heated debates. ProgPal is kind of one of them right now. Fund recovery is one of them, although I think that one's pretty much passed. I don't think anybody thinks that should happen. But I mean, I totally agree with you. Anytime someone links me to a coin vote, I'm like, this just can't, you can't take this seriously. And a lot of them, like six accounts have voted, right? Like someone linked me to a ProgPal vote that had five votes, and they're like, clearly the community wants ProgPal to happen. And it was like four votes for and one vote against, and there were like two ether staked it. I'm like, you can't do this. And I mean, obviously they're kind of one-off voting mechanisms, but like you said, if you actually had on-chain voting, it's just going to turn into plutocracy. And someone like, you know, I firmly agree, if EIP 999 was up for a vote and Parity could vote with their, I think they have like 300,000 ether locked or something like that, they would win just because they would outvote everybody else just due to apathy. So yeah, I'm not a fan of that at all. I don't know what I would call or how I would describe Ethereum's governance, but to be honest, to this point, I think it's doing just fine.
And I think one important note is that just because the voter turnout per address, so just because, say, there's thousands of addresses voting for something, it doesn't mean that that's not just one person splitting their entire stack across thousands of addresses, you know, using a bot or something to make it look like or give the illusion that there's massive voter participation, because that's definitely going to happen a lot, especially with these newer networks, you know, that have come online that have on-chain governance, such as Tezos and things like that, especially with obviously Polkadot's coming online at the end of the year. Their kind of on-chain governance system is one of their big selling points as well. Don't be fooled by these kind of thousands of addresses turnout sort of thing, because obviously it can be, you know, one person can own thousands of addresses or have a bot that just owns them all, runs them all, basically. So second last thing actually I've got on my list here that I wanted to talk about, the on-chain activity. So, you know, we spoke about Maker and DAI a little bit. I mentioned that the stability fee has now gone to 7.5%. So all fees accrued from, I think it was a couple of days ago, to the next time the stability fee changes will be charged at 7.5%. This was done, we've spoken about it on the podcast the past few weeks, this was done because the DAI was losing its peg. I think it dipped to like 94 cents or something, but didn't stay there for very long. But yeah, it got down to 94 cents and then went back to about 95, 96. And it's actually recovered since going to 7.5 to about 98, 99 cents. So almost back to its peg. And this is because people are burning a lot of the DAI or wiping their debts, which basically burns the DAI on their CDPs because the 7.5% fee is too high for them. This is literally what the stability fee's purpose is. It's functioning as intended. But this has upset people, of course, because people have taken CDPs, a lot of them, to leverage long ETH. And, you know, ETH hasn't been doing very well over the past, you know, few weeks, besides the little spike we had. So maybe they didn't want to close their CDP yet, but obviously they may feel like that, you know, this fee is too much and the price won't rise enough to cover their fees. So they may as well just close their CDP. And maybe they haven't just leveraged long ETH. Maybe they've used the DAI that they withdrew from their CDP to buy things, or, you know, spend it in other apps, or lent it out on Compound or Dharma or other apps like that. So different reasons, different people. But yeah, definitely the stability fee is working as intended. But another reason why people got upset was because this benefits the MKR token holders more than the CDP holders. Well, it doesn't benefit the CDP holders at all because they basically have to pay the fees. But the MKR token holders actually, you know, every time someone pays a fee, it's paid in MKR, and then the MKR token is burnt, which means less supply of MKR, and the MKR token holders benefit slightly from less supply, the price might go up, sort of thing. I don't think this is actually correlated at all, to be honest. The burn rate of MKR is very low. I think the price action that we saw over the past few months for the MKR token was due to just the project in general getting a lot of attention. You know, Uniswap, the volumes on Uniswap for the MKR pair and DAI shot up after Maker shut down their own decentralized Oasis DEX. Yeah, we spoke about that on the podcast a few weeks ago. So I don't think that the burning of DAI and the paying of fees actually affected the price too much. But people have been quite vocal about this. But yeah, have you seen this on Twitter as well, Eric?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess we've talked about this a good amount. It's funny, last time we talked, I think it was up to 3.5 and it kind of seemed like it was working, but then it kind of leveled off. So I guess that wasn't quite high enough. 7.5 seems like an extreme move that seemed to have worked. That said, you know, it's very extreme and kind of volatile, right? Like people taking out a loan like this don't want to have extremely volatile rates. Like they want to have some kind of predictability in their interest or amortization schedule or whatever you want to call it. I mean, CDPs are a little bit different, but and kind of their pay down, they want to have some predictability. So I guess at this point, yeah, some people just figured F it, it's not worth it. I would assume some people close too, just because of the wild volatility of what they're having to pay. But yeah, I guess at a point with Ether kind of settling out, we've been pretty flat, I guess slow down or flat for the last month or so. Some people that maybe took out some to leverage, like you said, maybe decided to just close. I suppose once we finally get the DAI savings rate, which kind of offsets finally the supply and demand of this, maybe we'll see a little more stability here, but hopefully we can kind of find a smoother path to this, right? Like you don't want to, I think just 2 months ago, it was like 1.5, then it went down to 0.5, then it was up to 3.5, then 7.5. And I know it's early and we're trying to find a way to settle everything out here, but hopefully it's a little bit smoother in the future.
Yeah, you mentioned the DAI savings rate. I think that will definitely help a lot, especially multi-collateral DAI as well. For those who don't know, the DAI savings rate is this kind of mechanism where people can lock their DAI that they draw and earn a percentage kind of interest on it. I think the introductory rate was going to be 2%. I haven't heard if that has changed since then, but this is basically a way to lock up DAI so that, you know, it's not just flooding the market basically. You know, but it depends how CDP holders want to treat their DAI, because you can think of it like they're taking the DAI out of their CDP to buy ETH to put back in their CDP, and that DAI is obviously flooding the market. Whereas with the DAI savings rate, they'll have the option of locking it up and earning percent, you know, each year. But that's quite small compared to how much you can earn from ETH. You know, there was actually a chart done by Matteo from the block in his Maker recap that I put in the newsletter. But it basically said that even if the stability fee was 100%, if ETH went up 10% in the week, that would still be worth it. I think the profit was still like 3% or something in the week. It would still be worth it for people to open a CDP, leverage along ETH, and then, of course, pay it back down after the week as long as ETH went up 10%. So, you know, it's a balancing act at the end of the day. We're going to see the stability fee change a lot, especially before multi-collateral DAI and the DAI savings rate gets put in. I think we saw, it was funny, we saw Justin Drake as well on Twitter, you know, bring up some criticisms about the Maker system and how, you know, multi-collateral DAI is probably too complex. Single collateral DAI can work, just fork out the Maker token. There's a whole thread there. I didn't link it in the newsletter, but just search Justin Drake on Twitter. I go through his profile. He doesn't tweet very often, so it'd be easy to find. But yeah, so he basically says, when was someone going to fork it, like Uniswap forked Bancor and remove the token? Oh, Uniswap didn't fork Bancor, but you know, it just basically is very similar to Bancor, but without a token. So I'm curious to see if anyone does actually fork Maker, because the project itself is very complex. It's not an easy project to just fork and go and you know, do something with. And I've spoken to a few people and they definitely believe that the MKR token can't be forked out of the system if you want it to work the way that the Maker team wants it to work, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Justin's a super smart guy. Everyone knows, I guess, at this point, I'm kind of a, this sounds ridiculous, but anti-token maximalist. Like, if there's any way to get tokens out, I think it should happen. I've talked to a lot of kind of Maker believers that are also hardcore Ethereum believers over the months since Maker's kind of got popular. And, you know, you've been in some of these conversations as well. And I've asked, do you think Maker could exist without the Maker token? It's kind of like a gray area. I mean, I think if they're very hardcore Maker people, they don't feel like they do just because of their holdings. And I know there's a lot of interesting mechanisms that go with the Maker token and all that, but I think Vitalik got involved in that thread as well. Something about like burning and giving token. Like, there's definitely a way to do this without the Maker token. Let's not kid ourselves. Like, there would at least be a way to experiment with it, right? Like, maybe, like you said, it's a very complex system and potentially it would fail. I don't know, but I do think someone is going to try this at a point, right? And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit cautious. I just mentioned a few minutes ago about this whole multi-collateral DAI thing too. And I don't know if Maker holders are ready for like the risk governance that's going to come with this. Like, these are very complex issues, right? Like, there's entire, like, part of my background's in risk management as far as finance goes, and there's entire fields and years of research and thousands of people dedicated to this across the globe as far as like managing risk on balance sheets and stuff like that. I'm not convinced that Maker holders are quite ready to manage the risk of all these different assets that are going to get added to this. So I'll be sitting from the sidelines. I'm not personally a Maker holder, but I'll be very interested to watch how this plays out.
Yeah. So I guess it's important to bring up that, you know, the Maker token has two core use cases, one of them paying fees for CDPs and the other being governance, of course. We've spoken about this in the past. I did bring up in relation to the low voter turnout, I didn't bring up on Twitter that maybe these kind of on-chain governance systems using a token should experiment with a use it or lose it model. So basically, if you own a token and you don't vote in, say, X number of proposals each year, you lose some of your token. You get slashed or something like that. Because I think Augur is actually integrating this in V2 for their rep token, where they slash people who don't participate. I think there's a bunch of mechanisms around it, but I really do want people to start experimenting with this a lot more, because we need some way to incentivize voters. You can't just have, you know, these Maker token holders, the fundamental reason why that their token's going to be valuable is if people are taking CDPs out and, you know, paying back their debts. And then also if the governance system is doing its job as well. So you basically have a kind of piece of the pie in governance and where you can dictate where the protocol goes. So you definitely want to see use it or lose it model come about. And as you were saying, maybe the token can actually be forked out and the project can work without it. Not sure how you do governance in that kind of system. I did see people on Twitter say that, you know, Ethereum and Bitcoin work without a native token to do kind of on-chain governance. Yeah, they do, but it's kind of a different thing. I mean, it'll take me forever to explain the differences, but it's definitely a different thing. But I would actually like to see that model play out. Maybe there is a way you can do it where there's like the same governance mechanisms that go into Bitcoin and Ethereum today can go into a dApp, for example, instead of on-chain governance. Because it's definitely a field that, as you said, risk management's huge. It takes a long time to work these things out. And, you know, one, Maker's building something that's never been done before. And two, they're trying to work out how to risk manage this thing that's never been done before. And three, they're doing on-chain governance, which is so, you know, very new. It hasn't been done for very long at all. It hasn't been done successfully for very long at all either. So this is why, I mean, this place, this kind of, this ecosystem is so exciting as well, because a lot of these things are brand new. It gives us an opportunity to watch it unfold and see what works, what doesn't, get involved as much as we can and everything like that. So really cool.
Yeah, I guess I'll leave with a bit of a controversial agreement here. So Justin, one of Justin's tweets said, building a maker-free, PETH-protected stablecoin as a pure public gold or good, somewhat like Uniswap Exchange, is an obvious opportunity. My thesis is that single collateral DAI works, can be improved by removing Maker, and that multi-collateral DAI is an overrated Rube Goldberg. I guess I'll just say I potentially agree with him on that. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I saw that tweet as well. That was quite an interesting tweet for sure. But I do agree with him to an extent. I don't know about MCD or collateral DAI being a Rube Goldberg machine. That's yet to be seen. It definitely is a lot more complex. But you know, there are other aspects of Maker as well that require kind of more centralized stewarding, I guess you could say, like the price oracles being one of them. But yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll see what shakes out. I would like to see something like, public goods, as Justin says, as make a single collateral DAI as a public good, basically.
Yeah. My fear is just around the complexity. I don't trust Maker holders really to be able to manage a system that complex, but potentially I'll be proven wrong.
I guess even if they're trustworthy, they just have shown that they don't really care to vote on these things.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So speaking of DAI, last thing I wanted to touch on was a tweet that I put out basically this week where DAI was integrated into what's called 0x Instant. So the 0x protocol's kind of instant trading feature. And this allows for trading of DAI and kind of other tokens directly in a tweet. So I've got the tweet in the newsletter. So basically you've got the embedded tweet, you press play on the tweet, little play button, and it comes up with this nice little interface, the 0x instant interface, and you can select how much DAI you want to buy from your wallet, basically. You click confirm, MetaMask prompt, it comes up with a prompt, and you say confirm, and there you go. You've got DAI for ETH or whatever it is you're trading. That's stupid amazing. Like, I can't, that got me so excited. Like, you made a comment on my tweet saying my head explodes a lot because I put a little exploding head emoji. I'm like, yes, it does, because it's freaking awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool. I had no idea that you could like integrate code into tweets like this. I talk about black magic about like ZK Starks and stuff. This was black magic to me. I mean, you could do DAI instant. And then I also saw someone integrated Uniswap into a tweet as well, which is really freaking cool.
Yeah, I think I saw that as well. It's just awesome. Like, so simple, because we see a lot of the Bitcoin proponents put out like kind of Lightning Network. I don't know if it's addresses or something got to do with Lightning Network. I think it's a Lightning address on a tweet, basically saying, hey, you can send money here, blah, blah, blah. Whereas, this is taking it one step further where you can actually do the interactive part in the tweet. You don't have to go somewhere else to send money to someone, to exchange money. You don't have to go to the 0x kind of protocol order book, or you don't have to go to Uniswap. You can just do it right in the tweet. So that was really cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, the UX is definitely getting there. Just like DAI Card, right, and Burner Wallet, you can send those links. So like if I want to send $5 to someone that has never used it, you just send a link, and the second they click it, they can redeem it. So that works well in tweets too. So, I mean, the fact that we're getting these DApp interactions into tweets is telling, right? It's getting a lot easier.
Yeah, it's evolving. It's getting, it's maturing, evolving a lot faster than I actually thought it would, which is really cool. It's cool. So thank you everyone for tuning in this week. That's all we've got. Obviously, if you want to look at everything that we talked about, you can go to ethub.substack.com. That's where our newsletter lives. And you can also subscribe if you haven't already. We send out the newsletter each week and then do the recap, of course. And you can also subscribe to the podcast that you're listening to right now at podcast.ethub.io. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.